This is episode 2 of season 2 of Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. I'm Peter Moore. Today I'm going to be talking to Thomas Harding about his book Legacy, his extraordinary and startling family story. Welcome to this episode of Travels Through Time. We're all familiar with the idea of the American Dream, a story of rags to riches through skill and perseverance. But what about the British Dream? Say a penniless immigrant turns up at the docks in East London and then rises to become a merchant prince in the great capitalist city. Well, this in shorthand is the story of Samuel Gluckstein, whose family became one of the wealthiest, most influential and innovative in 20th century Britain. Among many other things, they were the power behind the iconic Lion's Tea Shops that dotted the cities of the land. To tell us much more about this is the best-selling author Thomas Harding, a descendant of Samuel Gluckstein's and author of the new book Legacy. I met Thomas at his publisher's the other day to talk about the whole astonishing story. Welcome to Travels Through Time, Thomas.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Right, can we start off by talking generally about your family firm? That's what I'm going to call them today anyway, Lions. It's part of the nation's cultural heritage with its Swiss rolls, its nippies. That's the collective name we have for the waitresses that used to nip here and there, I suppose. I'm guessing this is something you've always known about and talked about in the family. Is that right?
No, that's not right at all. Growing up, I was close to my dad's family, the Alexanders. You know, I think this happens sometimes in families. You'll get close to one of your mother's side or your father's side. And so we were close to my dad's side and they had come from Germany. They were German Jews. We spent time with them for holidays, for religious occasions. I knew my mother's parents and I knew my mother's brother, but that was about it. I was born in the late 1960s, and so when I was growing up, it was around the time that the family firm, as you call it, was really collapsing. So I didn't really encounter them or from a cultural point of view. I mean, I consumed their products, but I never put two and two together. So, you know, whether it's Ready Breck or Lion's Maid ice cream or Swiss rolls or even Wimpy. There was a Wimpy up the road for me with its orange plastic seats. Remember those plastic tomatoes? But I never put two and two together. So I had absolutely no idea. The only thing I can remember was when I was 8 or 9 years old, my grandfather taking me to the Carvery in Marble Arch, which was a restaurant where you could basically eat as much meat as you would ever want to eat. And this guy would have a trolley, and on the trolley would be lamb and beef and chicken. And then afterwards, there was this another trolley with pastries and cakes and delights. And my grandfather said, you can eat as much as you like. Okay. And, you know, at
which
the time...
Which to an eight-year-old is quite an exciting proposition.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I had no idea at the time that he was chairman of the company which ran the restaurant. Mm. For me, it was just like this smorgasbord of delight.
Opportunity.
An opportunity, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so of course what we're talking about there is the very end of the of the company's existence. But if we go right back to the beginning, I think it's probably worth me whizzing through some of the early moments, because we're going to be talking about a later year and we'll get onto that very soon. But I wanted to just to pick up the start of the story so it all makes sense, hopefully. And it starts really in the Rhineland, doesn't it, with a persecution of a great-grandfather of a great-grandfather of a great-grandfather. I think that's how you describe him. And he's called Layman Gluckstein. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, so 200 years ago, I mean, I didn't know about this, but there were these things called the Hep riots, which was this anti-Jewish pogrom which swept from Bavaria up through what was then Prussia. And he was living with his family right in the northwest, just near the Dutch border. And it's just terrible. You know, people were killed and murdered and assaulted. That, along with these anti-Jewish rules and regulations from the Prussian government, pushed them out of what was then Prussia into Holland.
And then, of course, we get down to this character I've already mentioned, Samuel, the son, is that right?
Yeah.
And he was the one who made the journey in the 1840s to Britain, to London, more specifically the East End of London, which was the common kind of collecting ground for new immigrants at that time. And he arrived. I really like, there's a point you pick out in the book, the week he set foot in the docks of East London coincided with the launch of The Economist, a newspaper set up to promote economic liberalism. And there's a nice quote here from the first, I think it's from the prospectus for The Economist, when it says, "We seriously believed free trade, free intercourse will do more than any other visible agent to extend civilization and morality through the world." Well, that's a really zeitgeisty thing to say. He manages to establish quite a good business in the East End by the 1870s. Do you want to tell us what happens then, though? There's something really interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, he really, as you say, he built his business up from scratch, you know, first of all by himself, then he brought in his wife, and then he brought in various siblings. And by the time he got to 1870, he's doing well enough that he's actually employing servants, he has apprentices, he probably has, I don't know, 20 or 30 people working for him. He's now forms a partnership with his brother and brother-in-law, but it doesn't go so well. And they start arguing. And I think Samuel was a bit of a difficult character. And they ended up in court. And it wasn't just any court, it was the High Court. And on the one side, his brother and brother-in-law accused him of stealing an insurance bond from the safe, which he denied. And then he accused his brother-in-law of sexually assaulting his daughter, his teenage daughter. This is in the High Court, in the Palace of Westminster. And his son, his 15-year-old son, Monty, was there. And he witnessed the whole thing. And he was mortified, humiliated to have all this aired out in public. As a result of the court case, the judge ordered that the business be separated, split up. And Samuel walked away with most of the assets because he had invested most. But the biggest legacy of that moment was that Monty, the son, after Samuel died, as a direct result of this, what he called a trauma, he went to his brothers and brother-in-laws and said, "Look, never again. This is never going to happen again. From this point on, we're going to focus on family unity. And we're going to create this very, very strange thing called the fund." And the fund meant that from that point onwards, all the income and all the assets would be owned by the fund. So nobody would get a direct income. So whatever your position in the company, you got paid the same. But even more interestingly, if one person got a horse and cart, everybody got a horse and cart. So you had to wait until a business was wealthy enough, for example, to move to a better area. And this fund was an extraordinarily powerful vehicle to bring, to tie the family together. And it lasted all the way into the 1990s, so 120 years. And that was really the foundation of the family, which you can see as being an incredibly creative, dynamic force.
Yeah, really fascinating. You describe it as a community of family interests, the fund. It's been described elsewhere because it is quite a famous thing because it's such a bizarre idea that, and the fact that it endured for so long makes it even more bizarre.
And I don't think there's any other example.
No, but it's been called communism for millionaires, hasn't it? Which is a wonderful one once you read that line.
Well, for the male millionaires, of course, because the women were excluded.
Right.
So this was only for the men. And that's one of the interesting fissures right from the beginning.
Right.
That you see in the family.
That's an interesting point, and we'll just dwell on it for a moment, because you do look at these strong men, these characters like Samuel and Monty, who later builds a business up. We might mention him a bit more in a moment, but there are quite like powerful women kind of embedded all over. And there was one I liked, Mimi, was the one that kind of jumped out at me. And you've got, I'm going to give you this anecdote, because you talk about her thriftiness, and she was known for wearing the same hat. And when this was commented on after a very long time, she took it to the milliners. This was Mimi who did all the contracts, wasn't it? She looked after all those, but she took this hat to the milliners, and the milliner had told her that she was wearing the hat backwards. So she turned the hat the right way around and then decided, because it looked new, she didn't need a new hat. And I thought that was a really charming example of her, but one really which, like any charming example, tells a bigger story. She looked after the contract she was negotiating. So whilst you had these men at the front, which is only to be expected really in a patriarchal society like that, women weren't just sitting around in a kind of Jane Austen drawing room stitching away. They were making the cigars, etc., weren't they?
Yeah, right from the very beginning, the female and the male siblings were involved, and the wives were involved with the making of cigars, the selling of cigars, the negotiating of contracts when they started. They grew from selling the cigars in the streets to delivering them to the customers to their door to having stores. And by the 1870s, 1880s, they were the largest tobacconist in the country. Maybe they said the world. I'm not sure what was the world, but that was their strap line.
Yeah. You know, and so this was a great age of smoking, wasn't it? I mean,
exactly.
We could even, I suppose, if you think about it, famous silhouette of Sherlock Holmes with his pipe, he might be smoking some of your tobacco in that pipe.
Well, Karl Marx famously said he smoked the Samuel and Gluckstein, they were called Samuel and Gluckstein cigars on cigarettes and pipe tobacco. And they were very committed to advertising, and they were one of the early proponents of mass advertising. And their slogan was, "Smoke more, pay less." Karl Marx used this, and he said, tongue-in-cheek, of course, that, you know, as part of his economic theorem, that the more that he smoked, the more money he'd be able to save.
But I suppose if we go into the next iteration, because we think about the early years of coming over as an immigrant, then rolling these cigars, making the money, then there's a period later on around the Edwardian years or late Victorian times when everything just explodes, doesn't it? You go from being quite a wealth firm in the East End, which is on the up, to becoming Britain's biggest catering company, using this chap, Joe Lyons, I think his name was, as the name and the front man. But really all the brains, all the expertise, all the drive is coming from the Glucksteins who are there, and the Salmons, is that right?
Yes.
As well. So you get to the point, and this is where the book begins in, I think, the early years of the 1900s, where you have this very splendid banquet and trains worth of food being taken out of Euston Station.
90 turtles being transported up to Glasgow and up to Aberdeen.
Yeah, exactly. And it all really, you know, just develops from this point.
During those interwar periods, there's enormous growth. They went from having just a few tea shops to having hundreds of tea shops. They went from selling a little bit of loose leaf tea over the counter to being like the second or third seller of tea in the country. You know, they started selling ice cream, they started selling bread, they started doing coffee and cocoa. You know, they became the official caterers to Wimbledon, to the royal tea parties at the, you know, Buckingham Palace. You know, I mean, they were everywhere.
So before we dive into today's main business, I just want to talk very briefly about these tea shops, because they are probably the thing that people recognise and will associate most with the name Lyons. But they were revolutionary, weren't they? Because they catered for a different type of customer, and they did it in a different way.
So the first tea shop was just off Piccadilly Circus, it's 213 Piccadilly, and it was opened in 1894. And right from the beginning, Monty and his sister Lena, that their idea was, we're going to bring quality products at a reasonable price to the masses. That was always their thing. And particularly, they noticed there was nowhere safe for women to eat out in public. You know, there was slap bangs, there was chop shops, there was inns, there were taverns. But these places were rowdy and there was a lot of alcohol involved. They weren't considered proper for most women to eat out in. Let's create a tea shop where they could come, maybe before they go to the theatre, maybe when after they've gone shopping. And this was the time when the middle class was really growing, where people had a little cash in their pockets. And so they set up this tea shop with very basic fare at first, you know, sandwiches, tea, maybe a few cakes. And it became an instant success. And the waitresses were called nippies, and they really revolutionised catering. So, you know, people were able to eat an affordable meal. And reliably, so one of the interesting things they did, two things. One is you could buy the same thing in any tea shop in the country for the same price. No one else was doing that. So the other thing they did is they centralized production. So until then, a normal coffee house, for example, would make their own breads or cakes or pies were on the site. What Salmons and Glucksteins did, what Jay Lyons did, is they created a central production hub called Cadby Hall, which was in Hammersmith. They took over an old piano factory. And they made all the breads, all the cakes. They blended the teas in this factory.
So lots to say, a marvellous history, but really the point of today is to hone in on a single year. And we're going to look at 1934, the year that you've chosen, which, you know, is interesting for the family enormously, but it comes at a moment of kind of macro history. Big things are happening across Europe, and we should mentioned that the year before, of course, Adolf Hitler has been appointed Chancellor of Germany after the election that maybe didn't make them the biggest party, but brought them the most amount of seats. Got rising anti-Semitism on the streets, which is something the family is going to be nervous about from their, you know, experiences over the last 100 years. And you've got the rise of the British Union of Fascists and Oswald Mosley. Do you want to tell us what's going on with the Lyons family in 1934 before we get into your three seasons?
Yeah, so this is really the heyday of Jay Lyons and the family, the interwar years. Their brands are known by everybody. You know, it'd be a bit like Apple computers today. I mean, everyone knows Jay Lyons. You know, they either buy their products, they go to their corner houses or tea shops. The person who ran the company at that stage was my great-grandfather, Isidore Salmon. And he was a worker. He wasn't somebody who was into the publicity. He wasn't the kind of the person who's going to talk themselves up. He was a doer. He would just work incredibly long hours and get the job done. And he was brought up in a family who'd always taught themselves and their kids to keep their head below the parapet. Assimilate, assimilate, assimilate. Become like the British, be grateful for this country, do public service. And Isidore Salmon, as a result of that, had first been a London County Councillor and by this time was a member of the Parliament for the Conservative Party. You know, he wasn't in the cabinet, but he was a fairly prominent member. He was on various committees, especially to do with catering, especially to do with money and finances. He was a trusted member of the Conservative Party. He was the guy on the committees who would do the work, you know, while everybody else is taking the credit. He was also the vice president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. And the Board of Deputies was sometimes called the Jewish Parliament. It represented all the Jews in the British Empire. And imagine, the British Empire was enormous at that stage. And the other vice president was Rothschild. And if you remember, just after the First World War, the Balfour Declaration, which talked about the future of Palestine, that letter was written to Rothschild as the vice president of the Board of Deputies. So it was a significant position to have. He was part of the discussions about how to respond to the Nazi boycott of the Jewish businesses in Germany. Should there be a boycott of German goods in Britain? That was incredibly controversial. He said, no, let's just keep quiet about it. First reaction was always, don't be too hasty. Let the non-Jewish people complain. Let our friends in the non-Jewish community stand up for ourselves. We need to not make a fuss. If we make a fuss, then maybe the Nazis will use what we say to take it out on the German Jews, which, by the way, is exactly what Hitler did. He's part of the conversation about what to do with the future of Palestine. So he's right in the hub of that. And at the same time, the fascists are picking him out personally as a prominent Jew. You know, so in their newspapers, they're talking about that.
Well, I think that's, you know, the ideal primer for where we're going to begin. And we're going to start right on the cusp of 1934 now, with the new year maybe just a few days away. The opening of the Lyons Cumberland Hotel, the largest in Europe. What's going on? Where are we? Can you describe the scene?
So the Salmon and Gluckstein's, you know, they're sitting on this enormous success, but they've never satisfied with their achievements. They're always looking for the next big thing. And the next big thing was hotels. You know, they've done the tea shops. They've set up the Trocadero. They've got all their brands. Let's start with hotels. So the Cumberland Hotel, it's an incredible hotel right on Marble Arch. It overlooks Marble Arch. It's the largest. It's had over 1,000 bedrooms, hot and cold water in every room. And they're opening it right at the end of 1933, just before Christmas. And they invite the King and Queen to come visit. And the King and Queen do and it's not announced. They come and surprise everybody. And then a few days later, Isidore Salmon, as head of the company, hosts a gala dinner just before Christmas 1933.
Would it be like looking across maybe the cream of the establishment?
Cream of the establishment, the top business people, the business titans, the press barons would all be there. There'll be some celebrities, there'll be some film people, there'll probably be some famous singers, maybe 400 or 500 people in the ballroom of the Cumberland Hotel. And Isidore Salmon stands up. And don't forget, his background, his parents were Cockney London. He's had to do elocution lessons to perfect his English. He stands up with his, you know, he'll be in a penguin suit. He thanks the press for their attention, which gets a laugh because everybody there knows that actually what he's done is he's purchased their attention, because he's probably the biggest spender, or if not the biggest, one of the biggest spenders of advertising in the newspapers, because he's had this launch this massive advertising campaign for the Cumberland Hotel over the last few weeks. So that gets a big laugh. And then he invites the guy next to him, he invites him to say a few words.
This guy sitting next to him, I'm getting the feeling from what you're saying, is a significant person.
Yeah, so the guy sitting next to him is Viscount Rothermere, who is not just a press baron, he's the press baron. He owns the Daily Mail, he owns the Daily Mirror. He's the kind of person, I guess in today's terms, maybe a Rupert Murdoch kind of person, immensely powerful.
So looking at this top table, it's an immense projection of power. If you're looking at Isidore with his retail empire, I mean, he is a merchant prince, as we said before.
So this is almost like a coming out thing. You know, this is, okay, we have assimilated. We are more British than the British. We are, look at us. We're no longer dirt poor Jewish immigrants. You know, and Rothermere stands up, champagne glass in hand, and he proposes a toast to Isidore Salmon, thanking him particularly for his contribution to the country and the building of this grand hotel. And they all say to Isidore, and 400, 500 people raise their glass and say, Isidore.
So I imagine this is something which is reported widely in the media at the time.
Yes, yeah, widely.
So everyone's talking about it. I'm just, in a way, trying to build the scene, because this is something new for the family. You said they're going into hotels.
Well, I mean, this wasn't their first hotel. They had the Regent's Palace Hotel, the Strand Palace Hotel. But there was something about the position of this, right in the heart of London, the Marble Arch. It wasn't that they weren't competing with the Savoy. They weren't being Claridge's. It was still, you know, they were still middle market. But I think this ball, this gala event, this was for the top table.
Mm.
You know, the King and Queen had come the day before. The great and the good were at this event. So I think there was definitely a moment here where they would have said to each other, okay, I think we've done okay. We've done good here.
So,
and more than that, I would say, you know, I think especially in Jewish immigrant families, and this is probably true with other immigrant families, but a feeling of safety, like it's going to be okay.
Mm.
We can relax a little bit.
Well, exactly. This is what it seems to me is, if we are talking about this in the cliched terms of a dream projection for Samuel, 100 years before, this is exactly all he would have hoped for, to be, you know, toasted by the great and the good in a building which is owned by your family in a profitable business, of course. But on one sense, it seems, or in one sense, I should say, it seems, you know, they're a good pair, Rothmere and Isidore, but in another, they're not at all. There's a sharp difference between them. Do you want to tell us what that difference is?
Well, I mean, there's lots of differences, but one is obviously one comes from this immigrant Jewish family. One is this kind of this British kind of part of the British aristocracy. One is a media baron. One is runs a very large business, but also their politics are different, you know, if that's what you're asking. And, you know, Rothermere has been flirting with far right politics up to this stage, hasn't embraced it. But I would say Isidore would have considered him a friend, personal friend.
This is what I'm angling at, because I think it's, you know, just in terms of the picture we're projecting.
Of these two men.
You've got these two people here. There must have been whispers in the room saying, well, hang on a minute, there's this very wealthy Jewish businessman.
I'm not sure there was. I might disagree with you. I think that by that stage, I think that's why what's about to happen is such a shock. Because I think by that stage, Isidore wouldn't have seen that much difference. He would have seen himself as part of that the same club that Rothermere was part of. Don't forget, it had only been a few years that Lyons had purchased a quarter of the Daily Mail as part of an advertising campaign.
A quarter?
A quarter of one day's Daily Mail.
And this
Mail.
Is in the heyday of newspapers.
Yeah, yeah.
Well.
And so Rothermere was entirely reliant on Isidore Salmon and his advertising spend. They were enormous spenders. Because it's not just, okay, the Cumberland Hotel. Think about this rainbow of brands that they have. You know, this array of products and people and campaigns. So I'm not sure that Isidore would have seen himself as, maybe people have whispered behind his back, maybe, but I don't think he would have seen himself as being other at that moment. I think he would have reveled in it.
So from a scene of great opulence, we're going to go to something quite different. So if we can think of all the conviviality and cheer of the banqueting chamber, we're going to have a look at the Olympia rally of June in 1934. Tell us what the Olympia rally is first, and then we'll go and explain how it's happened.
So the Olympia rally was an extraordinary event. It was, I think it took people by surprise. If you read the newspapers, one of the wonderful things today is that a lot of the newspapers have been archived and digitized, so you can actually see how people are reacting at the time. They are shocked by what happens in the evening around Olympia, which was in West London, in Hammersmith. You have, over the course of a couple of hours, after tea, before dinner, somewhere between 14 and 17,000 people congregate outside Olympia. The vast majority are wearing black shirts. Many of them are carrying some kind of homemade weapon. Some of them are calling out things like, you know, Britain for the British, or Dirty Jew. And these are members of the British Union of Fascists, the BUF, Oswald Mosley's group. And there's a counter demonstration, many of whom have walked all the way from East London, which is a long way away. Maybe 2,000 to 4,000 anti-fascists, many of whom are Jewish, you know, who are, you know, crying out, you know, about fascism, and some of them also have weapons. And as the evening continues, there are two different spaces that develop. One is inside the hall, which is almost entirely fascists, With a few anti-fascists, and then outside it's about half and half. It's about 1,500 fascists and 1,500 anti-fascists. Why they're there is for a rally for Oswald Mosley, the leader of the British Union Fascists. And he's late by about half an hour, and eventually the arc lights come up, and he comes, walks through the hall, with this, surrounded by a phalanx of black-shirted thugs, and everybody's doing the fascist salute. And Oswald Mosley was, you know, he was in correspondence and supported by Mussolini and Hitler by this stage. He'd met Mussolini and inspired by Mussolini.
Yeah, it's one of these scenes, isn't it, that we look back on now with a lot of disquiet, because we know where that sentiment is leading. But at the time, it was something really exciting, wasn't it? But also, it was dangerous. This was a dangerous situation.
Well, up till then, he'd had a rally earlier, a few months earlier, and it had gone without really much notice because it had been another rally, a large rally, but not much anything else. What marked this rally out was the violence. So first of all, in the hall, some of the people who'd snuck in, the anti-fascists, started heckling Mosley. And he kind of, at first, he would like joke about it. He'd put them down. Heckling was a big part of meetings. My great-grandfather was a politician. He had to deal with hecklers. So it was a large part of politics of that day. And it could be rowdy. But what happened was it turned from ejecting these hecklers to beating them up really nastily. And there's terrible accounts by independent observers, some of whom are members of parliament, who describe the violence. You know, people not just being bloodied noses, but broken bones and serious wounds. And then outside it was matched by a total melee. I mean, close to a riot. It was the biggest violence had been seen in the streets of London in a generation. For those who are part of it, would have been intensely shocking and very, very scary. What's interesting, and I don't think it's a coincidence, is Olympia, which, as you know, we talked about earlier how Olympia was part of the family story. Olympia is literally next to Cabbie Hall, which is the centre of the Jay Lyons empire. And so my great-grandfather would have been looking out of his window at the riots.
Well, this is what I want to come on to.
As this thing unfolded.
This is what I want to come on to now, because you've got this moment it's basically a riot, isn't it? It's a big political rally. There's far-right people there. There's a few communists. There's Jewish people protesting against the anti-Semitism which is being spouted. I want to tie this back to the two characters we were talking about in our previous scene, because we were in that a quite comfortable banqueting chamber with Isidore and with Rothmere, and both of them are impacted by this. But let's start with Rothmere, because he plays a role, doesn't he, in making this event happen.
When I worked out the timetable here, I was really shocked. Rothmere has stood up and toasted Isidore just before Christmas 33. It was only 2 weeks later that he wrote articles in the Daily Mail and the Mirror supporting the Blackshirts and Oswald Mosley. You know, one of the headlines was "Hurrah for the Blackshirts." And if you think about that, how's that even possible? You know, 2 weeks ago, here you are, you're toasting your friend Isidore, who is, you know, a very well-known, not just as being a British business titan, but as being a prominent Jew, being part of the Board of Deputies. He was prominent member of the synagogue, and Rothmere would have been totally aware of that. 2 weeks later, he's writing shocking articles in the national newspapers calling for the support of the Blackshirts and actually seeing their historic role as a protector of British culture and British values. And I can only imagine that for Isidore, that it must have been an enormous betrayal. But what's important from the Blackshirts' point of view is that by getting the support of these two enormously popular newspapers, it incredibly increased the support and the membership of the British Union Fascists.
Well, it legitimised it in a way, didn't it?
Well, I mean, their membership rose up to 50,000 people. And of course, you know, the Daily Mail doesn't like talking about that today, but Rothmere was absolutely at the centre of legitimisation, the normalisation of the British Union Fascists.
Well, the Daily Mail might not like talking about it, but it is remembered as an infamous moment in British journalism. Because, as you alluded to then, these were mass market publications that were read by many, many millions of people. And if I'm looking here, I think you've got a part. When you talk about the British Union of Fascists, we might, in a way, think of them as a fringe movement which didn't gather an enormous amount of support. But you point here that they had their location at 33 King's Road in Chelsea, London, where Mosley was claiming that 700 members worked and an additional 500 SS men called a defence force were quartered.
Listen to that. He's using the word SS.
Yeah.
I mean, he's modelling entirely on what's going on in Germany and Italy.
So if we look back to 1934, at this point, there was two different paths that Britain could have gone down. And the subsequent history was very messy anyway. But this is a really crucial moment, isn't it? When you have such an influential person as Rothermere coming out and saying that. And this really does contribute to the amount of people that came out to Olympia on that day.
Well, listen to what he says. He says, Britain's survival depended on the existence of a great party of the right, with the same directness of purpose and energy of method as Hitler and Mussolini have displayed. And that's chilling.
And this, as we say, is coming from the proprietor of a really influential newspaper. So let's put Rothermere to one side for a moment, because the other person I want to talk about briefly at this point is Isidore. So you say he might be looking over the scene himself, as we're trying to do. And Olympia, for those of you who don't know, is an enormous exhibition hall which exists to this day. The family, are they still owners of it at this point?
They're not owners, they had been
they
owners.
They had been owners
they had
at
been
one
owners,
point.
Yeah.
And there's this, if you go back a generation to the 1880s, 1890s, this was the place where they were putting on these great exhibitions of Venice or Constantinople, where people would go in and they could actually go on the gondola or cross the Bosphorus or whatever they wanted to do in a simulated way, because they couldn't afford to go to these places.
Olympia was very much part of the family legend.
Yeah.
There was past, I mean, they were emotionally totally connected to Olympia. But he personally, Isidore, had been singled out by the Blackshirts. You know, they have this newspaper called Blackshirt, and his name was actually repeatedly talked about. They talked about, they put up warnings to drive Jews out of the East End of London, which were almost the same language had been used by the Prussians against the Jews in back in the 1820s during the Hep riots. Mm. He was seen as a prominent Jew. One of the articles was, the headline was, "Is Isidore a Jew?" And then proceeded to talk about, you know, Isidore Salmon and Jay Lyon. So he was very much in the thick of it. The Blackshirts had organised rallies and protests outside of corner houses and tea shops, because they'd acknowledged the family that owned the businesses as being Jewish. So this is very much a personal as well as a professional threat. But at the same time, Isidore had always learned to keep his head below the parapet. Don't cause trouble. Don't try and challenge what's going on. Don't say, you know, we're at risk. We mustn't be the ones. Work in the background. Always work in the background. You know, ask a friend to say something to stop this, but don't put your head above the parapet.
And as a mantra, that had served incredibly well. There's almost a sense of him being outed at this point, because even the selection of this Joe Lyon as the front of the business is because they were after a name that didn't sound a bit foreign. Is that right?
Absolutely, 100%. Just going back 20 years, in the beginning of the First World War, there had been a campaign launched by their chief tea rival, Lipton's, telling retailers and wholesalers not to buy Lyon's tea because they were a German-Jewish family. You know, this is a very real, this is not just a sense of kind of ethical question about anti-Semitism. This is a threat to their business. It was a physical threat to them, you know. So you can see this tightrope they're trying to walk, which is, you know, stand up for yourself, protect your business, protect your family, protect your workers. But at the same time, don't cause up too much trouble. Don't poke the bear.
I think it's interesting that, was it Joe Lyon who got the knighthood and then took a long time after for Isidore to get his?
Well, actually, I mean, Joe Lyon's got a knighthood. And then Monty, who was the real driving force for the business, said, actually, I don't want to be knighted. I don't want us to be seen as these uppity Jews. It was another generation before the first person, and it was Isidore who was knighted.
I think this is all full of dramatic suspense and historical interest, this moment, because we've really, I suppose, channeled the big forces of fascism in the 1930s into this strange friendship, which is very dysfunctional by the summer of 1934 between Rothermere and Isidore. Can you tell us what your third scene is going to be then? Because this brings the story to a head.
Yeah, so the what happens after the Olympia, let's call it a riot, there was enormous pushback. And I think Oswald Mosley was very surprised by this. People were shocked by the levels of violence. He tried to blame it on, like Trump, on there being two sides. You know, very similar kind of language. You know, there was two sides. Yes, our guys misbehaved, but those guys, they brought knuckle dusters to the fight. They knew what they were causing trouble. They were here to kind of stir things up. Those communists,
The Charlottesville moment, maybe.
Very like that, in terms of the next day. But people weren't buying what Mosley was selling. And I think Isidore, my great-grandfather, saw an opportunity. He saw an opportunity which was, if he was going to take some action, if he was going to leverage his personal relationship with Rothermere, now was the time to do it. Both being a board member of the synagogue in Bayswater, but also being the board of deputies, the vice president. And then, of course, he would have seen what happened in Olympia. He would have been there on that night. He decided to actually, now is the time to take some action.
What was that action then?
So he hunted Rothermere down and he said, look, you know, you've got two choices. Either you continue to support Oswald Mosley, in which case we will no longer give you our advertising, or you withdraw your support from Oswald Mosley and we can continue our flourishing and happy relationship.
Well, it's a very brave thing to do, isn't it? And it strikes me that you've chosen this as a final scene. I don't know where this meeting between the two of them happened. Do you have any archival...
There's some talk about a hotel. I don't know exactly where it would have been, so I can't pinpoint. It would have been London. It would have been soon after the Olympia and the days afterwards. We do have 4 or 5 different reports of it.
Mm, so it's verified in the documents. Yeah. But it strikes me that this is a proud moment for you, because this is the moment when he could... You know, there's been a long period before this where... You know, they're talking about boycotting imports from Germany, basically German products. And I think there's maybe a reluctance on Isidore's part to get involved with that, because it goes against the free trade ideals that he holds. But this is a point where he does stand up and say, hang on, too far now.
I mean, I think more than that. I mean, he was one of the strongest voices not to boycott German goods. He was very nervous of the response. I mean, one of the things you need to understand about Isidore, which is so interesting, is he was part of this Jewish group who were very anti-Zionist. Their fear was that by promoting a state of Israel for the Jews, the people of Britain would see the Jews as not British. He was very, very sensitive to that. So equally with Rothermere, he would have been very anxious about challenging Rothermere because of the consequences. Would people stop buying goods from Lyons because they were seen as unpatriotic? Don't forget, Oswald Mosley had wrapped himself in the British flag. Britain for the British. That was his big slogan. And if you go up against Oswald Mosley, there's a good chance that people are going to start seeing you as other, as non-British, as being disloyal. In fact, Mosley had cast the Jews as having loyalty outside of Britain. So there were real risks to Isidore. He saw this as the moment. And I think... Yeah, I think I am proud. I think that there was material reasons he did it. You know, I think he thought it would have been probably, you know, bad for the country politically. It was bad for business to have, you know, someone like the fascists having too much power. But I think mostly it was a personal. It was a point. It was what, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, so to say, where he said this is the moment. And I think he saw that he could do something. He was fiercely loyal to Britain, fiercely loyal. And I think he would have considered Mosley as un-British.
He was successful as well, wasn't he?
Very successful.
Rothermere did not write anything more of that vein. Is that correct?
No, he instantaneously pulled the support.
There wasn't many people who told Rothermere what to do. So in a way, that's another indication of the power of the family at that time.
Well, it's an extraordinarily... you can see a decline of the fascists from that point. Mm. You know, they were on this upward trajectory, and, you know, there were other factors, of course, but this was a very key factor, I think. The withdrawal of support, the very public withdrawal of support from Rothermere of the fascists.
So I think if we're looking, I'm just trying to take a step back and think about the BUF for a moment as a political movement. Do you really think at the time of the Olympia rally, when he strides in and the fascist salute goes up and people are chanting his name, is that really a bit of a high point in terms of popular support, do you think, for that movement?
Look, I've interviewed people in Germany, because I've written books about Germany and my family there, my father's family, and I've interviewed family members of people who voted for Hitler in the 1930s. And they saw him as patriotic. They saw him as being good for the country. They thought him as being good for the economy. They weren't driven by anti-Semitism. They were driven by a love of country. They were looking for a strong man. And I think Oswald Mosley offered very similar things. And it was only because he was outed as this mean-spirited, racist, small-minded bigot that the tide turned. And that was a huge moment.
What a story. What a story indeed. I mean, just give us a picture of Isidore. Where did he live? Where was he at home? I'm just trying to kind of leave this scene here with something vivid because I think he deserves it.
Yeah, well, interesting you should say he deserves it. I mean, he is not recognised in history. Even the family members don't recognise him. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, he lived in an apartment in Mayfair. He worked. That's what he did. He worked. I mean, he served as a Conservative member of Parliament. Even when on his deathbed, he didn't survive very long. He only survived until 1941. He was asked to reform the catering for the British Army. Up to that stage, the catering of the British Army was decentralised and was appalling. And he created the Army Catering Corps. And he was doing this even on his deathbed. And the War Office, I've seen some of the letters written to his wife after he died, and they wrote to him, the War Office, saying that he died in active duty. I mean, he died on the field of battle, is basically what they said. He was a man who just worked and worked and worked because he believed in
it. Well, perhaps he never did a better day's work than when he had a word with Lord Rothermere there. I think we'll leave it there because I don't think there's too much more to say, but it shows a very close view, I think, of an interesting character who had a profound influence on the history of that time. There's always a question that I like to ask of our guests right at the very end, and you have got so much choice. But if you could go back to 1934 and look over these scenes as we've been doing and bring a tangible object back to 2019, is there anything particularly you'd like to bring to have, maybe as a talisman in your writer's room?
I think I would like to have the glass that Rothermere raised to my great-grandfather Isidore.
Well, it's one full of narrative power for sure. Well, that's the end of our time trial. Let me just talk very briefly about the book because I've been absorbed by this. I think it's the most peculiar story that you could imagine. And I think, as I said right at the very beginning, it did remind me of the Franklin book in the sense that I think it will gather people up, this story, because it's full of will, ambition, hard work, perseverance. There's a bit of craft, a bit of guile. There's sometimes a bit of fighting on the streets of Whitechapel, but there's a lot of elegance as well. It's a story with lots of different facets. Did you enjoy writing it?
I totally loved writing it. And I mean, it gave me an opportunity to learn about a part of history I didn't know about. And it gave me an opportunity to meet really interesting people who shared that history.
Writing any family history is fraught with you know, subterranean mines, which can go off any second.
So there's still a conversation going on about what is the right story, what memories should be shared. But I think that's going to be true of any family. Mm. But yeah, they've been really kind and very supportive.
Well, I'll leave with some words of your own. You're right, legacy is my family story. It's the story of lions, but it's also the story of the Salmons and the Glucksteins, a family who transformed themselves from penniless immigrants to industrial titans and then to failed entrepreneurs. You'll have to read the book to find out what went wrong in five generations. It's a tale of tragedies, triumphs, loves, losses, and above all else, the loyalty that bound the family together. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today, Thomas Harding.
Thanks so much.
Well, that was me, Peter Moore, talking to Thomas Harding about his book, Legacy, One Family, A Cup of Tea and the Company That Took on the World. It's a very snappy subtitle for a book that I think you might have guessed I enjoyed immensely. To read about the family is really to read about the modern history of Great Britain. If our conversations stirred some interest for you in the 1930s or 1934, in general, then do head to historytoday.com where you can check out articles written by experts from the archives of the world's leading serious history magazine. For instance, you can read Beth Fisher, Appeasement, Britain's Political Turning Point, or Oswald Mosley, Anti-Semite by Daniel Tiller, or you can read Nick Smart's take on Neville Chamberlain's conundrums during the 1930s. We all know something about that. That's it for this week. I'm going to be back next Tuesday with Dr. Thomas Waters, who's a real-life professor of the dark arts. He's going to be taking us on a trip back in time to meet some Victorian witches. Well, people thought they were witches anyway. Till then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.